You're Going to Die, the podcast, is brought to you by YG2D, a 501c3 nonprofit bringing diverse communities creatively into the conversation of death and dying, inspiring life by unabashedly sourcing our shared mortality. To find out more, visit www.yg2d.com.
Are you all ready for some serious time traveling? Because trust me, listening to Martin Prechtel, you are going to time travel. So put your buckle on. Put your buckles on. Put your buckle on. What am I talking about? I want to share something very specific with you about having this episode's guest on the show. Something specific about what it felt like or what I realized as I was talking to them. I want to say that I'd read Martin Prechtel's book, the book that introduced me to his work, The Smell of Rain on Dust, when my mother died in 2003. And I remember exactly where I thought someone told me to read the book. I thought I was in Mendocino on my friend's property and my mom had just died and someone said, you must read this. And then as I'm talking with Martin, I look into this book and I see that it's published years later than that. And what I'm trying to highlight is something that I felt listening to him as we were in conversation and that I think you might experience too. So it matters to brace you for it, which is that there's some kind of time traveling possible with Martin. There's some kind of way of listening that is required of us that's different than what we're used to. Nowadays, maybe in a podcast, you wouldn't expect the first 20 minutes or so of the episode to just be the introduction that came only from me asking Martin to introduce himself. And I want to keep that here because I want to give us the chance to really be with what it means to meet someone in all their stories, in their lineage. And like someone in San Quentin said recently when they said Wopila as their word for checking in, this indigenous word that means gratitude, but it's more than that. It's seven generations of it, backwards and forwards. And forgive me if I'm paraphrasing that inappropriately or in limits, like not enough, but the message I got in San Quentin, it's something I feel now when I think about talking to Martin, when I think about all of you listening to this conversation, it is that we are in generations of meeting one another. We can be that way in this world and that it matters to do that. Like in the cancer patient workshop I had this morning, someone talked about getting to see a participant, a cancer patient that used to be in the group, who now has their second baby coming into the world. And the participant this morning in the group wanted to say, hey, I want to share with you that I talked to this person and that they're out there and that they had a new baby. And it matters to make room for that because there's a lineage in that group. The lineage of how we're all together now in the most meaningful of ways depends on how we acknowledge the lineage it took to get there. And not just our dead, actually, not just our ancestors, but the people that we're in community with that help build these and deepen these spaces. And by the way, welcome to You're Going to Die, the podcast. This is Ned Buskirk. I'm your host. As an avid student of indigenous eloquence, innovated language and thought, Martin Prechtel is an award-winning writer, artist, and teacher who, through his work, both written and spoken, hopes to promote the subtlety, irony, and pre-modern vitality hidden in any living language. A half-blood Native American with a Pueblo Indian upbringing, he left New Mexico to live in the village of Santiago Atitlan, Guatemala, eventually becoming a full member of the Mayan community there. For many years, he served as a principal in that body of village leaders, responsible for piloting the young people through the meanings of their ancient stories in the rituals of adult rites of passage. Once again, residing in his beloved New Mexico, Prechtel teaches at his international school, Bolad's Kitchen. Through an immersion into the world's lost seeds and sacred farming, forgotten music, magical architecture, ancient textile making, metal smithing, the making and using of tools, musical instruments, and food, and the deeper meanings of the origins of all these things in the older stories, in ancient texts, and by teaching through the traditional use of riddles, Prechtel hopes to inspire people of every mind and way to regrow and revitalize real culture and to find their own sense of place and the sacredness of a newly found daily existence in love with the natural world. I hope you enjoy this episode. Oh my gosh. Did you enjoy the bio? Did you enjoy the bio of Martin Prechtel? Well, I hope you enjoy this episode too of You're Going to Die, the podcast with Martin Prechtel.
I don't usually introduce myself because I usually let other people introduce themselves, but that's really a long story. If that's why, like, when I first heard your voice, I said, well, where are you from? You know, who are your people? And where's that accent from? And so me, I'm Martin Prechtel. Some people, my whole name, and that was given to me by and recorded by the census of the United States of America, is Terry Martin Prechtel. Every one of my grandfathers and grandfathers have the middle name of Martin. And my brother is John Martin. My dad is George Martin. My German grandfather is Edward Martin. My Indian grandfather is Edwin Martin. Everybody's Martin, so I got Martin. And and then Carrie, no one ever, except my mother, no one ever said that. Because where I grew up in a place that doesn't like to be publicized. So I won't publicize them because they're extremely old time bunch of Indians. They're still going strong. I just talking to a couple of us downtown, and they don't want nobody to know that they even exist, but they really exist. And they speak a language called Karis, which a lot of modern people haven't heard of. There's like 19 villages in New Mexico of native peoples or Pueblo peoples, and seven of those are Karis, and I speak Northern Karis, and I grew up with that. So they don't have any R in their language, so they wouldn't say Carrie, they would say Kellen. And so they just ended up saying Martin. You say, well, they don't have an R, why did they say Martin? Well, nobody called each other by their names, so we didn't grow up with our names, we grew up with nicknames. And so my mother was a teacher on that particular reservation. She's not from that place. I'm not any blood with anybody there. In recent times since we were all together as chimps. But so I grew up in New Mexico in a place that's really not, there's no crowding. I mean, you don't have to worry. Everybody you see, you want to talk to, because they're far away from each other. And we
walk. Any chance you get, right?
It's always interesting. And if you don't like them, you don't really have to see them because you can definitely avoid them.
Yeah, you can go far away. Right? Yeah, right.
And they probably did the same thing. So, you know, people were always extremely interesting to us and always have been to me. And so I grew up where I live now in Ojo Caliente, Nuevo Mexico, which is north of Santa Fe, you know, probably about 55 miles in a little ranchito. I grew up as an eagle's fly, probably same amount of distance going straight west-south. And very similar terrain, but a little slightly warmer, not less windy. And I grew up with people who were really from probably, you would like to say, maybe from the 17th, 16th century colonial Spanish era. No one spoke English. Everyone spoke Spanish as a second language. In other words, to get around, like the New Mexico legislature was still held in Spanish in those days. And not the Spanish they speak in Spain, but their own vernacular here. So we grew up speaking those languages, and I spoke some English with my parents. But so everybody was really multilingual, but nobody could read or write. And that includes some of our teachers. But we got over that, I guess. But so you say, how would I introduce myself? Well, because I come from immigrant stock, and I also come from native stock. And the immigrant stock start with my father's mother. She was an Irish woman, and her name was Winifred Regan Flannery. She was, sent to the Americas before the First World War because both of her sisters were sent to the Americas because their brothers were involved with rebelling against the English in those days before they had got independence from England. And, it was kind of dangerous, and they were doing all kind of goofy stuff. So my grandmother became a very classic Irish parlor maid and worked for the people who owned the Hanna Peabody Coal Company. They were the Hannas. It's a very, killing the earth, mining all the coal, doing all that stuff. But they loved her, and she worked in the building, their main mansion, doing all this, but she was the servant. And then my grandfather, who was half Moravian German and half Lenape, Wunami native, was working on the trains for the Hanna Peabody Coal Company. It was hauling coal from, mm-hmm. so who knows where, probably Pennsylvania, up into the Erie, Lake Erie region. And then they'd ship it all over to the steel mills and so on and so forth, where my uncles all died. And he was also a musician.
You said, Martin, sorry, you said where all your uncles
my uncles
died.
Died. Well, some of them did, not all of them. My father's brothers were not coal miners, but they worked in the steel mills, wore them down. And but my grandfather, he wasn't. He worked on the trains, and he was a drinker because all guys that worked on the trains were drinkers. Mm-hmm. And He also had a band, he had a little immigrant band. He played the guitar, and this guy played the accordion, and another guy that played the bass and went occasionally the tuba. And they were hired to play all kinds of soirees, you see. And my grandmother just happened to be the head servant, maid, the person who got all the food together for all these very fancy people with their lace doilies and this, that, and the other. Her fancy outfits. And my grandfather would always, his little group as a young man, who would get hired to play for these soirees, and because they owned the railroad, they owned everything, they owned everybody. And so they just pay him whatever they pay, a small amount of money for a musician, and he'd go and play at these parties. And so he was playing at one of these parties, and he saw this gorgeous Irish woman with this flaming golden hair, and didn't know what to do. He starts singing, my side of the family, the Preckles, God, they're shameless and sing, and they try to charm everybody. And, yeah, and he was no different. I have a recording, wax recording of him in 1917.
Oh my gosh.
Him singing his heart out, Unbelievable, unbelievable. Around the family. And, he sang his heart out to Grandma. Now, Grandma was taken, and they, they would meet in the kitchen, in the servants' quarters, not in open view. And they got to know each other, and they fell in love. But then my grandma said, let's get married, And he said, okay, fine. He says, but you got to quit working for the trains. He says, I'm going to make a living, can't do it making music. So she said, I'll talk to my boss. And so she talked to her boss, and he gave her husband, I guess it was, 40 acres, as a loan to sort of sharecrop on some place there called Dover Village, which is where all the Lenape Indians had been living. This is where my grandfather was from. And so he became a farmer. And, and she said, you can't drink anymore. Well, he didn't get that part, but he got the part about farming. And he started farming.
He never farmed before. It wasn't a part of the family
lineage.
Not
that I know of. It's not clear to me, but he was awfully good at it. So it's very suspicious that he didn't know how. You know what I'm saying? Very suspicious. But him and my grandma had a ton of children. Five of them died in World War One. During and after World War One. And they... then they started having kids that survived, and there were my three aunties who were looked like little movie stars or tall movie stars. And then she started having boys, and the last boy she had when she was 52 years old, and he was a twin, and that was my dad. And so he was the spoiled one. He's the one that got a tricycle and the one that had, like homemade sunglasses and all that. But my grandfather hated machines. My father's father hated machines. He didn't like cars. He thought they were a horrible invention and everybody would get over them. He loved horses and he loved mules. So he had two mules and two ponies. And he had a truck garden of 40 acres, and he used to, what his main bread and butter was selling grapes to a winery to make wine. And then the rest he grew in, you know, cabbages and all kinds of fruit and stuff, and he'd sell in a farmer's market. And whenever, you know, he'd go and sell, he'd make enough money, get himself pretty tanked up with all his buddies in town. And then they'd drop him in the, passed out in the wagon, and just hit the mules, and they knew exactly where they lived. And they took my grandfather asleep in the wagon back to his house, and my grandma would take him out and put him beddy by until he came around, and then they'd start over again. And that's the life he lived. But my father's brother bought a Model T, no, Model A, I think it was at that by that point, and a tractor. And my grandfather would never forgive him. He says, we're not using fossil burning things here. This is counter, this does not make life. It doesn't make food, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so they were arguing, everybody's arguing, you know, it's the way of the world, blah, blah, blah. World War One had killed all these people. It was a horrible situation. And so there's a lot of funny and not funny stories about it. But my father's brother, Eugene, my uncle, what happened was two of the ponies fell down the well and they couldn't get them out. And my grandfather used his mule over the pulley to try to pull them out. And he lost his temper at one point because they couldn't do it. And they just couldn't, you know, it's a lot of weight, you know, it's, you know, 800 pounds a pony. And he's trying to pull, and they couldn't do it. And then my father hit one of the mules really hard to, you know, well, he shouldn't have done that, but the mule lashed out and kicked him. And where he kicked him was in his arm, and sliced his arm up all the way to his armpit. And when that finally healed later on, when they healed it up, he could never bend his left arm again. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the aspects of old Ed. And then my uncle, of course, on that day, took his tractor and pulled the ponies out with it and said, you see, machines are better. And so, as he was driving,
he knew that was coming.
But as he was driving away from the place, because my grandfather would not allow the machine on the property normally, these are really old, rickety, horrible, gigantic, unwieldy tractors, and it rolled over on my uncle, and they had to amputate his left foot.
Oh, wow!
And so, as the story goes, now you're going to know all about me from this, is that they had this little tiny house, you know, with eight children, you know, and my grandfather lived in the barn that he renovated so my grandmother and him could get together, you know, and be intimate, because you're not going to do it with eight kids in a house, one room house. And so my dad never put that together until I told him. He said, oh, you're right.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's common sense, man. Come on. Wake up. So, anyway, they're all sitting on the veranda, supposedly, but I wasn't there, of course. You know, I wasn't born. My dad was a little kid and young man. And my Uncle Eugene's yelling. He says, no. He says, machines are better. It's the way of the future. It's easier for us to farm. No, horses are better. Animals are better because they eat what we grow, and they get along with us, and they keep warm, and they don't take so much energy, and they're not ruining the earth. And back and forth they go on it. Finally, my grandma comes out on the veranda and says, listen to me, you chumps. Nothing's better. Farming's hell. The only thing that makes life good is that we love each other and we do the best we can with what we got. Now let's eat, you know. And that was my grandma. So
yeah,
that's my dad's side.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Quarter native, quarter German, and all Irish. And so that's why I talk so much. Got that Irish.
I love it. I love that, like, this podcast episode will be just you introducing yourself.
Well, it generally is. That's why I warned you. I was 6 hours of saying hello. I'm shaking hands. And now, what did you want to talk about?
We're out of time, everybody. Have a great day.
Well, that's what life's all about.
That's right. I mean, you know what it connects to,
actually. They don't do it anymore. People meet each other in the street, and they don't do that. You know, Navajos meet. I don't know if you ever met a real live Atanani, Kantashanani. And when they meet in the street, if they meet in the street, they never say their names. They never say who they are. They say where they're descended from, who was this, and what is that. And then they compare notes until they finally find somebody who's related or not. And then eventually somebody else has to be asked to find out what this guy's name is because they don't say him. And so I kind of come from that, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. You're in for a lot.
I'm feeling it.
Over, you know. I mean, my grandma's amazing.
No,
I love.
No, her. I want to keep. I want you to keep going on this trajectory, and I want to acknowledge something that you're saying that feels important about what we don't do, and part of what your book, you know, The Smell of Rain on Dust, really like sat with me out of reading it is there's a part in the book towards the end where you talk about what does it mean to pay attention to everything, to know everything, and to know you can't know everything, but to know that you wanting to know everything is a form of praise. And so listening to you, like, that's right. Listening to you feels like that. It feels like someone who has committed to knowing everything.
Well, that's why nobody remembers anything. Yeah. They don't remember. Their memories are shot. They're all committed to the computer. They'll do it for you. And then your synapses don't ever develop, you know? Anyway, grandma was a great person. She was really good when she got really, really old. I didn't know her until I was five, of course, because I didn't live there. We lived here in New Mexico. But when I did meet her, she loved all the little children. She was amazing. She just loved kids. And I had never seen a sycamore. There are some sycamores in New Mexico. They grow in this one little patch south of Albuquerque, but I've never seen one there. But she had sycamores all around their place. And so she'd take it out, and then we'd bust the sycamore balls, and they go into fluff. And like when I was 4 and 5 years old, I thought this was the most cool thing in the world. So every year after that, she would send me a little box of sycamore balls, you know. And that was my relation with grandma. And she got to the point to where her memory started to fail. And so she was a lot of Irish women were very good at writing. You know, I mean, their calligraphy was just so beautiful, their orthography. And she used this little sepia and, these crow quill tip pens and writing this beautiful stationery. And she wrote some of her friends every single day and then, you know, we'd post it. And she was writing to one of her friends, and she, you know, put the letter in the envelope and sealed it up. But she accidentally wrote her own address on the front of the envelope. You know, getting to that age, I think, where we all get to. And so the return address was the same as the forward address. And she just gave it to my uncle to send as he was going off to work, right? And so he sent it, and of course it came back to Winifred's house, you know, 2 days later, and she's reading it. Says, "Dear friend," and the friend starts saying all this stuff that the friend is doing, which is, of course, is her. And she goes, "Wow, this person had a day a whole lot like I did, but wait a minute, it is me." And she said, "I wrote myself a letter, but I didn't remember half the stuff that went on there." And so then she started writing herself letters on purpose every week so she could remember what she was last week. So she started having a conversation with who she used to be. And she did that till the day she died. She wrote letters.
Oh, my gosh.
And they sent them off.
How many letters do you think? How many letters?
I don't know. There's a big old pile of them, man. Really don't know, you know. And they're so beautifully written. Yeah. And so she'd read and say, "Wow, I did something. That was very good. That was smart. I used to be really smart." You
know? Oh,
and
so, my gosh.
And I think if I have any...
I used to be really smart.
If I have any, you know, remote writing ability, that's where it came from. Because everybody else was, you know, right. And so anyway, that's Grandma Reagan. She was amazing, beautiful lady. Now my mom's side, they're sad people. They're sad, angry,
sad bitter, people.
Bitter, yeah. You know, not successful at living. They weren't farmers. My mother's father was Indian, tried everything he could to tell everybody he was French. And because it was not cool to be an Indian in those days, you know, anymore. It was cool to be black or a Mexican in those areas. And so she grew up, they were from Canada, but she grew up in Detroit on the other side. And he worked for Henry Ford, you know. And he actually, our family says, you know, it's probably not even true, but, you know, family mythology that he invented, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, the Ford pickup, you know, that little dinky, cute little thing they made when they first made a pickup, which I doubt is true. But anyway, we thought it was. And all the Indians I knew, you know, they drove Ford pickups. So we always drove Ford pickups because we thought grandpa made them, you know. But he... He killed himself when I was about 4. And most of my mother's relatives killed themselves. And they were, you know, very, very sad and depressed bunch. and not happy in the ones that survived, except for a couple of aunties and uncles who were actually Scottish Métis. One of my mother's great aunt Helen and my great grandmother Louisa, who was always, it was really something. She was good running for the other grandma. She was quite an amazing woman. She was a horsewoman and she did a lot of crazy things too, which I won't bother you with now, but it was really quite amazing. But my mother was one of two sisters and no brothers. And my grandfather was always mad because he hadn't had a son. And so my mom was going to show him. And so she went to school and became a man, basically. You know, she learned to fence, she learned to shoot arrows, she learned to ride horses, she learned to shoot shotguns, she learned to do all these things, and got her degree in biology and thought she would become an educator. And so when she married my pop, who was just out of the World War II, my father ended up, my father, by the way, was only 5'4", a towering individual, and my mother was 5 foot even. I'm 5'6", which is like 2 inches taller than my dad. Mm-hmm. And so he couldn't get into the army in World War II because
of that.
Well, he was too short. But then they didn't have invented the Air Force yet. They had the Army Air Corps, and they needed guys that were short who had passed all these tests. And so my father was enormously intelligent. So he passed, he went and applied and passed all these tests and became a fighter pilot instructor. And they sent him to Childress, Texas. Now, from my dad, from, you know, Ohio, Dover, a village outside Cleveland, where it is now, it used to be a farming town. But this was like amazing, like wide open land for as far as you can see, flying in these crazy airplanes, you know, it was just amazing. But he was amazingly in love with other people, too. And all of his comrades in this crazy war effort were all short guys. And most of them were Jews. They were, you know, they were Jews that were willing to fight against Hitler. They were Mexicans. They were willing to fight against Hitler. A few Indians and a few black guys who were not so short. But his commanding officer was a very famous senator whose name I probably shouldn't say because you don't need to get sued, you know. He's dead now, but, you know, he was in the Senate for a long time. And that was his commander. He hated Jews. Ironically, in World War II, he didn't want them. He thought they should be annihilated. So he would never pass, even though they were in the fighter corps and my dad was a teacher, he was a flight instructor. And he always gave them the grade that they deserved. And he always noticed that they always got sent to the front with these terrible bomb crates, you know, that they were sending out of Sicily. And he said, well, they can't be, man, because this guy got, you know, a strafing, you know, exercise grade that was really high. So he snuck in to headquarters, you know, it's before computers and all that, and went through secretly with a little flashlight, you know, and saw that the grades had all been changed and that, so that these guys would wash out of, you know, fighter pilot school and go out of the elite corps, you know, into the grunt corps. So my father, of course, being my father and being what he always was, he changed all the grades back. Only he gave him a little bit better grade.
Even better.
Yeah. And he got away with it for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But then they caught him. And so they said, okay, well, then you can go there with all your little, you know, I won't say it on the air, but, you know, all your friends. And so he was sent to Sicily, and he was a bombardier. And he was bombing, you know, the Siegfried Line. He was doing all this war, terrible war, and dropping these bombs, those skip bombs and all kinds of heavy tonnage. And eventually he mostly bombed oil fields and, you know, trains and bridges. And he could hit them. He showed me how he did it with, you know, their little spider web crosshairs, you know. Mm-hmm. And he showed me how he'd bomb. This science is ridiculous. You know, you do just like you do on the reservation, you know, just back and forth, and you hold your breath and you wait to the right moment. You know, it's going to take that long to get there, and you're off the target, and then it's on. And you hit these things that no one could hit. But it never occurred to him, you know, that he was bombing people. And one day he got shot out of the sky when they were coming. They actually finally had, you know, gotten farther north in Italy, and they were actually bombing Germany. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, he was bombing Munich. And he didn't make it to Munich because one of the anti-aircraft blew out one of his engines on the aircraft he was in and killed most of the guys. And there were two of them left, and they floated the airplane down over the Alps. And by the rules of the game, they were supposed to drop all their bombs because you can't land with bombs, live bombs, of course. And he was supposed to drop them in the Alps. And he looked down at the Alps and said, man, I love these mountains. I've flown over there. I'm not going to drop bombs on the Alps and people that are down there and sheep and cows and... Well, no. Mm. And so the next possibility was down in the Adriatic, is to fly over there and then down past into the Isle of Pag in what was now, in those days, Yugoslavia, and dropping a bomb on a town called Ljubljana in what's now Slovenia. And he said, man, Ljubljana, Ljubljana. And he looked down there and he said, Ljubljana, I wish I met a girl named Ljubljana. Man, that's a beautiful sounding name. Am I going to drop bombs on a town named Ljubljana just because it's invaded and, you know, been invaded by the Nazis? And so he went out into the ocean and he let his bombs go in the ocean. So I don't want to do it to the ocean either, but that's better than Ljubljana or the Alps. Mm. And he belly flopped the plane with his, what was it, you know, with the tail gunner with him and who's in his co-pilot. And he flopped it down there and they got out in their little rafts and they ended up living with Tito's resistors, you know. they found them. And he said, this is the best years of the war. We drank wine, ate cheese, and never talked politics. Mm. And I didn't do anything except get along with these resistance guys and eventually got him back to Italy. So the reason I'm telling you this story, I know it's boring the hell of you, but that's
no,
what,
it's not.
That's what I made out of, okay? That's what made me what I am, if you were interested.
Yeah, I want
but that's
all
not
that.
The end of it, because my dad...
I know, I didn't think so.
They gave him a commendation. They wanted to give him a medal. They gave him a 2-rank promotion from a second lieutenant to a captain. He refused the promotion and refused the medals. And the reason is because the day they were supposed to, you know, pin these medals on him, on this garbage, you know, as he put it, he visited an orphanage in northern Italy. And in this orphanage, there were kids. There were German kids, Austrian kids, Swiss kids. And believe it or not, there were some from the Middle East. Kids from everywhere, Hungary, you know, just all over. And some of them have arms, some of them have hands, and none of them had parents, and none of them could speak the same language. And my dad, one thing he always had was chewing gum. He's a farm boy, you know. He always had chewing gum, and he always had, you know, silver dollars. And so my dad had his back turned to the kids, and he heard one kid say to him, he said, hey, G.I. Joe, he said, stick a gum. You know, so my dad was getting ready to pull out a stick of gum. And the kid who was saying this, he didn't have any hands. He didn't have any arms. His both arms had been blown off. But he had a mouth and he could speak. And his best friend had half his face blown off. And he couldn't, do anything. And so the one kid who had arms but couldn't speak grabbed the gum out of my dad's hand and tore it in half. And give half to his friend who didn't have any arms and stick the other half in the half of his cheek that still had teeth and chewed. And at that moment, my father cracked. And he said, I'm making kids just like this. I'm killing people and I'm doing this. I'm blowing people up. This is what I'm doing. You're going to give me a medal for this crap? Mm. And so he quit. He said, no. And he had only 2 more missions to go before he was done with his stint. And so, you know, the doctors got a hold of him and said, well, it's just, you know, battle fatigue. No, it was an attack of sanity, you know. And my dad became a pacifist. And they sent him to what is now known as Israel, which was called Palestine in those days. And he spent the remainder of the war, which is only, I think, 4 months left, 3 or 4, visiting prisoner of war camps and getting to know people. And as you say, really digging the taste of olives and chasing camels around. And then he got sent back to the States. And when he got back to the States, you know, he was a wreck, you know, needless to say, but he was sane in the most insane way. And because he didn't believe in war, he knew that the war was something that had to happen, you know, he thought, at least in his mind. But when he got back home, he took the GI Bill and got himself, what they call a stipend in order to attend the college, which had never happened with any of his chums or any of his homies or any of his people.
No one had ever gone to school.
Nobody had gone to school.
Yeah, right.
So he goes to this school, which was in Berea, Ohio, and called Hiram College. And he goes there. And at night, this idiot, you know, my dad is in it with his 410 shotgun shooting at bats in the dark, just like he used to do in the, with airplanes when he shoot the enemy, right? And how do you hit a bat with a shotgun, for God's sake? I don't know. Anyway, well, he had the very bad luck of having actually shot through a window on the second story of one of the dorms. And a lady came out of there, you know, boiling mad, and saw him and took his shotgun and broke it down, pulled the, you know, the cartridge out of the chamber and grabbed him by the ears and dragged him into the mess hall and gave him a dressing down, was going to turn him over to the authorities. And then she saw how cute he was, you know, and that's my mom. That's how my mom and dad met, him shooting bats, you know, coming out of the war, and she tried to tame him up. And so he became a paleontologist, says, I want to be as far away from machines, just like my dad. So they moved to Wyoming and made me in the Wind River Reservation. My mom gave up the, you know, big career, but she did become a teacher, and then it became a little too cold in Wyoming, so my mother said, let's go south, and she found her a job on a reservation here in New Mexico, and that's where I was raised up. So there you go. That's me. And, of course, you don't know much about me, but that's where I come from.
Two things to stop you with here for just a moment. Two things I need you to do. One is rate and review the show. You all are doing it, and so I'm going to keep asking. We are getting people rating and reviewing the show. In fact, let me just read a couple of sweet words from recent friends who have popped in to say, hey, this podcast matters. Here's one titled Enormous Gratitude, 5 stars. How lovely that musings on death are so utterly life-giving. As a therapist, I share this podcast weekly with humans as a tender tool to explore the specific textures and layers of our experiences with love and loss. Simply put, I love this podcast. First of all, thank you for that. And I can't pronounce the name that you put in for your rating and review. So I'm just saying thank you. You know who you are. And this one too, Riribex. The title of this one is Here for the Tears, 5 stars. The empathy is real and a green heart. Thank you, Riribex. And you out there, if you've rated and reviewed the show already, thank you so much. And absolutely, if you have not, go do it now. Okay? It matters. People notice, we notice more importantly, and I might read your words on the podcast. So pop them over. And then the second thing I need you to do, our nonprofit, 501c3, we are in the midst of a community fundraiser right now. We are well on our way to our goal, and we need your support. Just go into the show notes and click on our Give Butter fundraiser link and contribute today. You are helping us not just produce this podcast, which is yours for free, by the way, but it also will help us do all the work we're up to with our prison program, our hospice program, our work with cancer patients, our work with the elderly. The list goes on, and we hope to expand all of these offerings, but we need your support to do it. So please go into the show notes now, click the Give Butter fundraiser link, and contribute today. Thank you. you know, I did want to ask you this, Martin, knowing where you are and knowing maybe your aversion or dislike or just, I don't know, not inclined to using technology and being in the life you're in. I guess I wonder why you said yes to being in conversation with me on a podcast called You're Going to Die. I mean, is there anything to say?
Well, I kind of like the idea of somebody doing that. I used to always say that in my school, and everybody was horrified. I said, now, I don't know, maybe your mama forgot to tell you when you live, but you're going to die. It's just a matter of when. And yes, the only thing you have in your control is the means of your demise. Okay. And it depends how you go about living. The main thing that really counts is to live and to do really good living. And so, I have no aversion to the technology. I have aversion to what happens to people when they think technology is the only thing happening. Mm-hmm. You see, all your high school students and all that. I, as you can see, I can talk perfectly well on the mic and wear headphones and play rock and roll and do all this stuff, but that's because you got to know everything there is to know. And you got to know everything about everything, but the technology does not cause you to know everything. And a lot of people think it does. That's the only thing. I just want to straighten that out.
That's right. Okay? Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
Like a lot of people say, oh, you hate white people. I don't hate white people. What are you talking about? You know, I hate whiteness. But I love the white people. I go see them all, man. Come to my house. I will hold you all and keep you from yourself. It's white people. I don't hate that. I don't hate technology. I don't hate anything. What I do have is an aversion to the cowardice of people being able to live. And I'm not wanting to take the time to bless because, as you say, you're going to die. And so what are you going to do with the time that you are here? You're going to just get a bigger jolt, have more comfort, have a bigger drug experience, have more ayahuasca, have more this, more big that. So you go, the deliciousness of actually having been alive tribally is not known anymore. Once you feel that, you go, whoa. And the weirdest thing is it lives in the smallest places. And if you can't see those things, with the vision that you have or hear them with the hearing that you have or understand them with the understanding that you have, then that's what you got to work on, man. And it can't be done alone. This is the weird thing, because the strangest thing with all of this technology is everybody's communicating and getting along and everybody knows everybody. And people are lonelier and far away from each other than they've ever been in my estimation, man. And I live in a state that had low population until now. I mean, there were 800,000 people in the whole entire state. In my county, I don't think there was as many people as there are in Santa Fe now, you know. So everybody was like, wow, let's go talk to them. Man, they must be cool, you know, or maybe they're not, but it'd be interesting. So is that interesting? No. What is interesting is that dying has become the only thing that you can threaten anybody with in order to get them to do something like more work instead of praise, which is always being given in order to get more work out of people instead of to giving them more life. We are noble by birth, noble by our own natural implication, our inclination of life. But that don't matter to most people. They're so in a hurry. No, let's get to the next one. Instead of, whoa, hold on, man. Have the courage. Here comes the trouble. All right. You're going to die, you're not going to die. Most people don't want to hear what I have to say unless I am dead, because they love to listen to dead people. They listen to Tolstoy, you know, they listen to Dickens, you know, they listen to Gandhi, you know.
This book traveled, though, I know, but this book traveled.
Yeah, but see, you have to be dead to talk like a dead.
That's right. That's right. That's why someone out here, my friend's like, he's dead, right? Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
I tried that. Anyway, you don't have to be dead to talk like a dead person, but a lot of the people out there are dead, and they're saying stuff that's killing everybody. All right. And so what we're talking about is liveliness, man. All right. So the thing is, if you speak praise in order to get what you want, that's not praise. That's called seduction. Okay. And seduction sucks. Okay. What we need is courting which is where you try to make the other person or whatever you're speaking praise about to be seen by somebody besides yourself, and that will not give you what you want because you said it. It is not a NASDAQ investment, an emotional investment. You can't say something to get something. You have to say it because it's the right thing to do. If you see a teenager that's admiring a sunset, you know, a punk ass, weapon wielding drug head who's really digging the beauty of the sunset, and you don't say, "Yeah, man, I did that sunset," and you go along with them and praise the sunset with them, then you're just as criminal as that guy. All right. You have to be able to know that we are blessers by nature, and there is no goal in life. In other words, we're not supposed to get anywhere by enlightenment or anything on the other side. We're supposed to live well in order to pass a world that we will never see to somebody we don't know. If you do that, that actually causes you to become a human being now. But you'll never know it until the people talk about it later on. So death is just basically a fulcrum on a teeter-totter, all right? And this is not an end. It's only a middle. And people don't understand that the middle of things is where all stories begin. Stories do not begin at the beginning, don't begin at the end. Time doesn't begin. There's no such thing as the beginning of time. What's that? They're ridiculous. Or the end of time. It's ridiculous. There's only middle of time. And where is the middle of time? Right now. Where we are is the middle of time, since it's infinite in both directions. So we start to bless from where we stand, and it spreads just like an organic root and grows this plant called the future that we will never see and gives a fruit of hope. So God will be able to bless. And when we lose what we love, that means what? That means that we loved our foot. It means we loved being alive. Mm-hmm. It means we loved being here with this person or our horse or whatever. My very most sacred, best horse just died 3 weeks ago, mysteriously. As my wife said, he died to keep you alive, man. It's the most beautiful, beautiful stallion. I've been working for 25 years to breed him, and he wasn't even old. He just ran out and died. And I grieved him so much. But the praise, the heroic praise that comes from that is what gives life. It's not about living beyond yourself or getting something that you want because you say, it's like a guy... Or somebody falls in love with a man, falls in love with a man, or a woman with a woman, or a woman with a man with a woman, all these stuff. They're saying things that they think the other one will want to hear because then that person will give them what they want. No, not at all. You praise because you want them to feel good, because you just love them so much. You want them to feel like beautiful and happy. And also you want the rest of the world to see how gorgeous and wonderful this person is. Not because, if I say this, I'll get that. Or if I do this at the business meeting, I'll get that. Oh, that's such crud, man. So the noble soul wants to make praise, and everything does. In other words, it builds a building that's gorgeous white, because everything that sees it will then be radiating that feeling of that building, or will have the vibration of that bounces off of. Everything that is done so that everything can give life, be given life by it. And animals and plants do this. You read the books of Ed Young, he's a scientist and he can't say what I'm saying, but he would if he could get away with it. He'd love to, I love him. I think he's great. But considering the box he's in, he's pretty amazing. I love animals and I study all the time, and we have it in our traditions too. So everybody says, well, Nat Martin, he talks a lot and he says a lot of things that makes me feel like I'm nobody. Well, I'm not trying to make you feel like you're nobody. I'm not trying to make you feel insignificant. Or I'm trying to say you can. You have to, if you're going to be a person and you're here, it's not a choice, man. It's an obligation to praise. It's an obligation to grieve. It's an obligation to make your grief into praise so that eventually the thing you're sad about becomes something that gives life. Because if love doesn't have grief in it, you ain't in love, man. You ain't in love, because it's going to have grief in it. Okay? So, if you have children, you'll know what they mean, man.
Yeah. I hear, you know, in a way that connects to the title of your book, that there's a chapter that I think importantly speaks to what you're saying now, right? It connects to what you're saying now, which is, you know, this idea of like rain. And if you speak and pray for rain and speak love for the rain, then you'll get the rain. You know, in a way that's like offering praise to get something.
Yeah, same.
And in the book you argue, you say, no. Like the way you're speaking is the rain. You express the love is the rain.
You be the rain. Your body's the rain. Your mind is the rain. And with the rains there or not, you got to do that. Yeah, no one prays for rain here. No Indians pray for rain. And nobody calls rain. We are rain the way we are. And so the smell of the rain on dust and places that aren't dry, they don't know what that means, because it's places, you know, they go up in smoke all the time. But everybody's getting used to it, I think, you know. But what you do and what you say, it really does make a difference. Not because you're getting or not getting what you want, but because something is fed by the way you are. By the beauty that you can make, and by the beauty of the way you waddle down the road, and the way you try to talk to each other, and the way you fail, man. It's all right to fail. Hello, everybody out there. This is Martin Practical telling you that it's okay to fail, long as you fail beautifully, okay? As long as you fail beautifully with the intent. You got to make beauty. That's all there is to it. Okay, so that's, anyway. Well, what do I know? I just, you know, I told you about my grandma and my grandpa.
You know everything. You know everything.
No,
that's
I don't know
point.
Everything, but I want
okay,
to.
Well, you want to.
No, my
you
daughter knows
to.
Everything. She tells me all the time. But anyway, you got to laugh. You got to cry. You got to live, man, because what the hell for? You know, you're just going around with a face. You're going to scare the food with that frown on your face. Okay, you're mad about the way things are in Israel. So am I. But you got to make life. You got to turn the bullets into corn, baby. Okay? Mm. You turn the bullets into corn. You got to read more of my books if you don't know what that means. But the good thing about you're going to die is the fact is that everything else already has died. And you're still here. And you're only here because those other things died. And so let's make it so that when you leave, I leave, when anything leaves, which it all does, and it leaves a light. It's like those stars again. That are burning brightly from nebulas and places that no longer exist, at least not physically, but their light does. Mm-hmm. And the power of that light turns to sound and it makes matter. And that matter is what we live through. And so if you can make a praise and make a love and make some ingenuous or ingenious way of keeping things alive, then they can die well. Because the whole idea is to die well, not to not die. Immortality is a cop-out. The idea is to have a mortality that creates more living mortality in the future. Okay, so even Tolkien said that. God bless his crazy soul.
Even Tolkien,
yeah. He did, I say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he said the Manwë give the gift of mortality to men because the elves were sick of never being able to die. And that which made their life so precious, which I also said. I've said that. And it's the great stakes of being alive is the fact that you're going to die. But most people interpret it as I'm going to get all my everything. I'm going to get my share before I go. I don't get a jolt and I don't care who I run over, even though, you know, I talk a big story. You know, they're so terrified. I remember working with gang kids, you know, they said, well, there's no life after 18, so we're just going to shoot anybody we want and take all the drugs we want, do anything we want, and then we'll die. So, well, hold on a minute. Hold on a minute. What about the idea? You're going to die. You want to do something really great for what you love, which precludes the idea. So you got to learn how to love, man. So that's what it comes down to. Love, reverence, and being able to praise. Not just God, but if you believe only one thing, I mean, it's kind of boring at one God, but if you got one boring God, you got one boring God. You got to praise, you know? You got to praise, man. You got to praise the thing that made you have the pain to lose. In other words, if you say, well, I just hate God. Well, that's kind of a form of praise, you know, as it says, you know, I don't want to lose my dog, so I'm never going to get another dog because he got run over. Hey, get a life, man. I love my dogs, you know, and I hate it when I have to shoot them when they get old, but I still got another dog. And the love I have for the world and everything, it just keeps going on, man. So you got to be able to praise, you got to be able to sing, you got to be able to make art. You can't just sit on your butt and wait for the comfort, you know. Yeah.
I love that ending. Two things I want to ask before I go. I'm wondering about your horse. Can you talk briefly about how you honored that horse and its death, or if there's like, I don't know.
First of all, you've got to do something for me and quit calling my horse an it. Because English is really bad with that. Babies are its, horses are its, trees are its. It's a he. He was a he, just like you are.
Thank you. Yeah, you're right. Thank you.
I'm not chiding you, but I am sorry. Yeah, it's not an object.
Yes, of course. Yeah,
I don't miss objects. I miss beings. And so, you know, when I lose a bracelet, I make another one. When I lose a horse, I can't make another one. So...
Thank you.
This horse's name was Yamparica, and his father's name was Punk. I didn't name him, a bunch of little kids did. And he died when he was 40, and Punk was the father of the one that just died, and he was most amazing, and he died in Thanksgiving this last year, and we never thought he would have lasted that long. He was supposed to die like 5 years ago, and when he died, I knew he would take his son with him, and I have 5 other stallions, their grandsons and great-grandsons of them. And this is a rare, rare breed of horse that was brought by the Spaniards, and the natives took it over. And I wrote 3 books on it, so you don't worry about that. But this one did. And when he died, then what I do is, it was pretty snowy coming down at the time, you know. So me and Jake had to hoist him. He died in my arms. It was amazing. I had gone to town to deliver my girl to high school, and had come back, and he was missing. And my wife found him, and he was down. And then when I came, he stood up for the last time, and I talked to him, and I sang him, and then he just melted down. He was dead in 2 minutes. And it was very uncharacteristic. Nobody knows how it happened, why it happened, except spiritually speaking. So I took him to, and there's 2 kinds of way we do with horses. One is to do the mound method, where you put them in the ground like a burial, and bury them with lots of goods and songs, which is how I did his dad. Because I killed his dad, because his dad couldn't get up again, so I had to put him down. I shot him. But this one, he died on his own. And so we took him up to the mesa, which is, you know, a couple of miles from here, overlooking our house, because so I could let his souls go into the wind. And we believe one soul turns into wind and one soul turns into the ground, which is the physical body of the animal, my old boy. And then the other soul, it goes to the Pleiades. To the gathering of stars that is at this time setting very early in the evening. And so we send it up there. And so you point his body that way, and then you sing it. And you make his body into the whole earth, every part of his hoof. Just like the nomads in Central Asia used to do too. They all forgot now, but they used to do that too. This hoof is from here, and this hoof is this part of the world, and this hoof is part of the world, and this part, and this, and the withers is this, and the tail is that. And then you slowly walk the whole world up to his nostrils. And with all of these different kind of substances that you have there, really precious, all ground up, we always have them. And then you release that soul. And then by the next morning, he's gone off with the stars. And usually there's a big storm, which there was. It almost knocked my barn down. And he's running wild as another thing. He's not a horse anymore. He becomes a star, you see what I'm saying? But one of them becomes a wind. They have 3 souls. And the other one becomes the earth. And that's how we did it. I mean, it's more complicated than that. And then we give a lot of jewels, so many necklaces, many blankets. And then we put a great big piece of turquoise in his mouth. You can get it open and stick the turquoise. So his words become really, really brilliant, you see. And so on and so on and so on. And then every 40 day you give a gift again, where, you know, by then the coyotes will have torn him to bits. And there's no buzzards right this time of year, but... you know, all the different animals have eaten and gotten their bit. And so you fed the animals, you fed the wind, and you fed the stars, man. So there he is. And then the next baby horse born, which, strangely enough, he bred a mare before he died, you know, a couple hours.
Oh, my gosh. So really? Wow. It'll probably be
they have 11 months gestation, but this particular mare goes a whole year. So she'll probably give birth to another animal. We don't know
wow.
successful, but that's life, man. And that's the beauty. Mm-hmm. And then you sing, you weep, you sing as hard as you can, and you sing as loud as you can, and you weep as much as you can, and send them on the way. It's just like gasoline in your old engine, man, you know. It's like juice in your car, man. It's like a good meal, you know. It sends it on its way. Yeah. Anyway, that's how we live.
More from Martine Prechtel. First of all, definitely read the book The Smell of Rain on Dust. Can't recommend it enough. And Martine recommends other books more than that one. So go to his website, which is linked in the show notes, and you can get all things Martine Prechtel. There's books, audiobooks, audio series, lectures. It's all there. Martine asked me to highlight something specific, and that is his audio lecture series, Please Come Sit by My Fire, Talks from the Flowering Mountain. Go and check out that link in the show notes as well, and subscribe to those talks that Martine is offering from his place in New Mexico. Other than that, thank you all so much for listening. It matters so much to be in your ear. If you want to rate and review the show because you didn't when I mentioned it earlier, why did you not do it yet? Now is the time. If you're spending your life listening this long to an episode this far in that you're hearing the closer, then definitely this matters to you enough to go and rate and review the show. Go please and do that. And connect to us on social media. Click the link in the show notes too for our fundraiser. We are raising money to keep this podcast going. Do you want more episodes? We need your support. Other than that, feeling especially grateful today for you, dear listener. I mean that. I hope it doesn't sound weird when I call you dear listener, but I feel that you're a dear listener. That you being alive matters. If this moment means anything to you, know that like I'm feeling that right now, feeling gratitude for your existence, that your ears exist, and that we, You're Going to Die, the podcast, gets to be in them. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.